Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Cruel and Unusual Punishment for Minors Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On May 17, 2010, the Supreme Court announced its decision in Graham v. Florida. The question in this case was whether the imposition of a life sentence without the possibility of parole on a juvenile convicted of a non-homicide offense violated the Eighth Amendment's prohibition of cruel and unusual punishments. By a vote of 6-3, the court struck down the sentence. In an opinion for the court written by Justice Kennedy and joined by four justices, the court held that the Eighth Amendment does not permit a juvenile offender to be sentenced to life in prison without parole for a non-homicide crime. Chief Justice Roberts wrote a separate opinion concurring in the judgment on the ground that the particular sentence at issue in this case was unconstitutionally disproportionate under the court's precedents. To discuss the case, we have University of Florida 11 College of Law Assistant Professor John F. Steneford. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Steneford.
Hi, I'm John Steneford from the University of Florida, and I'm here today to talk about Graham versus Florida, which was decided on May 17, 2010. Now, Graham versus Florida is a case that arose under the Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause, and in that case, the Supreme Court held that it's unconstitutional to impose a life sentence without possibility of parole for juvenile non-homicide offenders. This is an important case for a couple reasons. First of all, this is the first time in a century that the Supreme Court has declared a punishment other than the death penalty to be categorically unconstitutional for a particular offense or group of offenders. More broadly, this case shows an increased willingness by the court to base decisions about the constitutionality of a given punishment primarily on its own subjective judgment rather than relying on external standards such as the original meaning of the clause or evidence concerning societal moral consensus. Okay, let's talk briefly about the facts of the case. The defendant, Terrence Graham, when he was 16 years old, was involved with a couple of other guys who committed an attempted robbery of a restaurant. During the course of that robbery, one of the co-conspirators struck the manager on the head with a pipe, but they failed to get any money. Ultimately, Graham was charged with armed burglary and attempted armed robbery. Ultimately, however, the judge decided to give him 3 years probation for that crime on account of his youth and his lack of a prior record. Now, about a year later, Graham was caught after going on a fairly nasty robbery spree one night, which involved holding victims at gunpoint and which culminated in one of Graham's co-defendants being shot. When arrested, Graham admitted to participating in two or three robberies prior to that time. Now, these later robberies were violations of Graham's condition of probation, so he was brought back before the court for resentencing. This time, the judge decided that Graham was incorrigible and sentenced him to life in prison, which was the maximum punishment permitted for the crime of armed robbery. Florida has eliminated its parole system, so this sentence meant that Graham truly would spend the rest of his life in jail for a crime he committed when he was 16. He appealed this sentence to the Supreme Court on the ground that it was cruel and unusual punishment. Okay, let's talk about the court's analysis a little bit. And first of all, I want to give you some background. This case is what's called a proportionality case. That is, Graham isn't arguing that life sentences are always cruel and unusual, but rather that they are excessive or disproportionate in relation to a non-homicide crime committed by a juvenile. Now, the Supreme Court's proportionality jurisprudence has a checkered history. It's been around for about a century, but in general, the court has been highly reluctant to strike down punishments on proportionality grounds for a couple of reasons. First of all, proportionality is hard to measure. We all understand the principle of an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, but it's difficult to figure out how this principle helps us determine exactly how long a robber deserves to be in prison, for example. It seems to be a very subjective, hard-to-measure sort of thing. Second of all, there are lingering doubts about the legitimacy of proportionality review under the Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause. Originalists like Justice Scalia have argued strongly, although incorrectly, I think, that the Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause was intended to outlaw only barbaric methods of punishment and not disproportionate ones. Third, the decision to strike down as disproportionate a legislatively authorized punishment creates major concerns regarding federalism and separation of powers, particularly given the difficulty in measuring proportionality and the doubts about the legitimacy of this kind of analysis. Again, if proportionality is a subjective matter, many people would ask why a court is better situated to measure it than a legislature. So as a result of these concerns, proportionality review under the Cruel and Unusual Punishments Clause seemed to be dead, actually, for about 20 years, from 1983 to 2002. But starting in 2002, the Supreme Court started to revive proportionality review in some death penalty cases. In the late 1970s, the court had declared the death penalty unconstitutional for the crime of rape. In 2002, when it revived the doctrine, it went on to outlaw the death penalty for the mentally disabled. In 2005, it did the same for minors. And finally, in 2008, the court declared the death penalty unconstitutional for all crimes against individuals that did not involve homicide. Now, at the same time, the court seemed to be trying to stamp out any effort to challenge sentences of imprisonment as constitutionally disproportionate. For example, in 2003, the court upheld a sentence of 25 years to life under California's three strikes law for a repeat offender who shoplifted three golf clubs. And they also upheld a sentence of 50 years to life for someone who shoplifted about $100 worth of videotapes. So at the very same time the court was sort of giving robust proportionality review in death penalty cases, it seemed to be trying to eliminate the proportionality doctrine with respect to prison sentences. Now, and throughout this time period, the court justified the disparity in its treatment of death and imprisonment cases by saying that death is different. Death involves a total and irrevocable deprivation of life and liberty, and therefore the court is more willing to intervene in such cases than it is in cases involving imprisonment. Now, with the Graham case, all of this changed, at least potentially. Rather than applying the stringent test it normally employs for cases involving prison sentences, the court used the approach it had reserved previously for death penalty cases, and it did so in a highly expansive manner. So now, what is that approach? What approach did the court use? Under the approach the court follows in death penalty cases and now in Graham, the court takes two steps to determine whether a punishment is grossly disproportionate and therefore unconstitutional. First, it looks at legislative enactments, jury verdicts, and sometimes other evidence to determine whether a given punishment practice comports with the, quote, evolving standards of decency that mark the progress of a maturing society. Sometimes, controversially, the court will also look at evidence of international moral consensus for or against a given punishment, again, to try and determine whether society condemns that punishment. Secondly, after looking at evolving standards of decency, the court then exercises its own independent judgment to determine whether a practice should be outlawed. Now, in Graham, there was a fairly weak case that the practice permitting life sentences for juvenile non-homicide crimes violated current standards of decency. This punishment was actually permitted in some 37 states, as well as the District of Columbia and the federal system. On the other hand, the punishment is rarely imposed. Only about 12 jurisdictions have imposed this sentence recently, and there are only about 129 offenders serving sentences that fall into this category currently. Now, the court took the rarity of the imposition of such sentences as evidence of a societal consensus against this practice, although, as Justice Thomas pointed out, the evidence could be viewed as showing not a consensus against the practice, but rather a consensus that this punishment should only be given rarely. Finally, again, before moving on to its own independent judgment, the court also took notice of the fact that international practice appears to forbid sentences of life without parole for juvenile non-homicide offenses, although the court claimed that this fact was not dispositive in its decision. Now, the real action in the Graham case occurred when the court moved away from current societal standards and instead looked to its own judgment. Specifically, the court reviewed evidence that minors as a group are relatively impulsive and irresponsible and thus less morally culpable for the crimes they commit. The court also looked at evidence that minors as a group are more susceptible to rehabilitation than adults are. And given this evidence, the court said that in its own judgment, it believed the sentences of life without parole are too harsh for juvenile non-homicide crimes because they will result in many people who, when they grow up and mature, could turn into good citizens. Many of those people could end up serving life sentences. So the court ended up striking down this punishment as a categorical matter and said that any life sentence imposed on a juvenile had to involve some meaningful opportunity to obtain release based on demonstrated maturity and rehabilitation. In other words, you can impose a life sentence so long as you give a meaningful parole possibility to the juvenile, but otherwise you can't do it. Okay, a couple final points. Chief Justice Roberts wrote an interesting opinion concurring in the judgment in this case, in which he argued that cases like Graham should be reviewed on a case-by-case basis rather than the categorical approach that the court took. Chief Justice Roberts said that although many juveniles like Graham seem less morally culpable than adults, some juveniles commit such horrifying crimes that they may deserve life sentences, and Chief Justice Roberts wanted to preserve the flexibility to allow such juveniles to be given true life sentences of imprisonment. Chief Justice Roberts' opinion was sort of an interesting road not taken, as it could ultimately have opened up the court's proportionality review to a broader range of cases without creating the same risk of judicial legislation that we see in the majority opinion in Graham's case. But, of course, this road was not taken, so we may never know where it would have led us. Finally, a couple of open issues that remain after the Graham case. First of all, the Graham case explicitly involved sentences of life without parole for non-homicide cases for juveniles. There's a question as to whether the court will now look at homicide cases and decide that sentences of life without parole for juveniles in homicide cases may also be unconstitutional. Given its reasoning about maturity and rehabilitation, it seems logical that the court may do this. Also, there's an open question about long sentences imposed on juveniles that fall somewhat short of life. For example, can you give a juvenile a sentence of 40 years in prison with no possibility of parole? Justice Alito, in his dissent, argued that such sentences are still good after Graham, but again, that's an open question. Finally, there's the question as to sort of what sort of a parole system the court thinks the states need to set up in order to preserve their ability to give life sentences to juveniles. The court said there must be a meaningful opportunity to obtain release, but there's a question as to what this will require, and there may be further litigation about that. And the very final question is, what will happen to the 129 offenders who are currently serving sentences of life without parole for non-homicide crimes? Many, if not all, are in states that have eliminated the parole system. So when they come up for resentencing, there's a question as to what sort of sentence the judge can give, given the fact that parole won't be available as a practical matter. So thanks very much. That's the Graham case in a nutshell.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.